Iran reiterates that it is in compliance with the JCPOA after the US said it was not sure whether Tehran wanted to come back into compliance. Iran urges the International Atomic Energy Agency to distance itself from any political agenda and avoid voicing artificial concerns. Also ahead, the World Health Organization chief says COVID-19 vaccine inequality has created a two-track pandemic, with Western countries protected and poorer nations still exposed. Our top story, Iran's foreign minister says Tehran still does not know if the current U.S. administration is ready to change its predecessor's policies regarding the Iran nuclear deal. In a tweet, Mohammad Javad Zarif said Washington needs to, quote, bury the failed maximum pressure policy of Trump and seize its economic terrorism against Iran. Zarif's remarks came after U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Washington, which left the nuclear deal in 2018, is unsure whether Iran is ready to resume compliance with the accord. Zarif said Iran's gradual scale back of its commitments is in accordance to the terms of the deal, which stipulates that one party can reduce its obligations if others fail to meet theirs. Political commentator Frank Emspach says the lack of leadership on the part of U.S. President Joe Biden is the main issue hampering progress in the JCPOA revival talks.
Certainly, if one side violates the treaty, the other side can pull out. Well, the United States violated the treaty, it pulled out. And so the Iranians went to the Europeans and said, look, we still want to play ball here. Help us out. We don't want you to agree to the sanctions. And the Europeans made some steps, but never put into real play the other trade agreements that they said they would do. So, you know, from the Iranians' position, they're saying, who are these people? That makes perfect sense. But this isn't a question of trust. This is a question of, is the United States going to do this or not? And there are certain clear indicators one way or the other. One of them is going to be financial transactions. Another might be not sinking Iranian ships, whoever did that. Another one might be to allow the oil to begin to circulate more. These are things that could be done as confidence-building schemes, and I think that's what everybody is waiting for, and I believe everybody has said that. Both sides have said that. They know, everybody knows, what specific things can be done to build confidence. This isn't a question of trust. It's a question of doing something. And I think the world, not only Iran, but people here, want to move here. I think there is a feeling that we should have some kind of normal relations with Iran. But unless that happens, unless there's some leadership, and the leadership is probably what the Iranian government is looking at here, or the lack thereof, and we don't see that.
The International Atomic Energy Agency says the nuclear watchdog has adopted a biased approach towards the Islamic Republic. Kazem Gharib Abadi warned that such an approach could hamper future goodwill interactions between Tehran and the IAEA. He urged the agency to distance itself from any political agenda and avoid voicing artificial concerns. Gharib Abadi added that the IAEA must take a clear stand on Israel's nuclear threats and place the regime's nuclear activities and facilities under its safeguards. On Monday, IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi accused Tehran of failing to answer questions about what he called the discovery of uranium particles at undeclared nuclear sites in the country.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA's Board of Governors, convenes a week-long meeting to discuss monitoring and verification in Iran, among other issues. Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi expressed concern over a lack of progress in discussions about the presence of nuclear material in four undeclared locations in Iran.
The Iranian government has reiterated its will to engage and to cooperate and to provide answers, but they haven't done that so far. So I hope this may change, but as we speak, we haven't had any concrete progress on any of the issues.
Iranian ambassador to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, says he's asked the agency not to use some unimportant issues dating to around two decades ago as an excuse to politicize Iran's case at a time when negotiations are underway to revive the nuclear deal between Iran and world powers, known as the JCPOA. Grossi acknowledged there's nothing that indicates there is a danger when it comes to the safeguards-related issues, but stressed that the agency would not stop asking questions. In his latest report, Grossi also said the agency's access to Iranian nuclear facilities has been restricted since the 23rd of February as a result of a parliamentary law that obliges the government to go ahead with enrichment and other nuclear activities and to deny the agency broader or complementary access beyond the country's regular safeguards obligations. Under a temporary agreement between Tehran and the agency, valid until the 24th of June, the IAEA will continue to collect data at Iran's key nuclear facilities via its surveillance equipment, but will not be able to access that data. Grossi said an extension of that agreement was becoming increasingly difficult. Iran says it will transfer all the collected data to the agency and return to full compliance with the JCPOA after the verifiable removal of all U.S. sanctions. Omar Lizgi, Vienna.
As candidates are doing their best to woo voters, officials and supporters of candidates are also seeking to encourage more people to go to the polls on election day.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Election Special. Thank you for joining us. With less than 2 weeks before Iran's presidential election, the country's election commission has called for a mass voter turnout. The commission's spokesman, Ismail Mousavi, said over 59 million people are eligible to vote in the June the 18th election. He said there will be more than 72,000 polling stations across the country, up by more than 10,000 compared to the previous elections in order to alleviate concerns about the coronavirus pandemic. Mousavi also emphasized that all candidates are required to comply with the health regulations in their electoral campaigns, warning that any violations of the protocols will be met with punitive measures. Well, the candidates approved to run for the top executive posts are talking about their plans to resolve the country's problems. The first candidate we are going to talk about is Ebrahim Raisi. He is running for president on a platform of tackling economic problems such as poverty, unemployment, and inflation. In a campaign rally on Monday, he once again reiterated his promise to put an end to corruption. Here's more.
In the past 2 years, as the head of Iran's judiciary, I've seen many court cases that show people's concern about corruption and discrimination. My administration will have no red line in fighting corruption. The root cause of injustices in the executive branch of the government must be dried up. The banking, tax, import, and export systems must be reformed. And if the government's monitoring of goods, currency, and communications increases, we will not see a corruption case in the country every single day. God willing, with your help, we will resolve the problems. I think it is quite possible to change the current situation.
Another presidential candidate is Mohsen Rezaei. He says his potential administration will be one of action and breakthrough. Rezaei says the governance system in the Iranian economy needs to change. In his latest interview, he has outlined his plan to boost domestic production.
We'll improve the conditions necessary for businesses. This means that we lower business costs. For example, sometimes when a producer wants to take out a loan, they have to wait for 6 months. This results in an increase in expenses for that business. But my administration will increase profitability in the production sector by decreasing such business costs. We'll also levy taxes on non-productive sectors and cut taxes on production sector. We'll also use new technologies like fintech, blockchain and cryptocurrencies.
Alireza Zakhani says different sectors in the country have the capacity to create 1 million or millions of jobs for the people. The principalist lawmaker says his administration can create over 2 million jobs in the next 2 years. Let's take a listen to what he has to say.
I believe Iran has many capacities, so if we manage to activate these capacities, we will even be needing labor forces from abroad. We can make a minimum of 500,000 jobs in the first 6 months, and then 1.5 million jobs the next year, and then 2 million jobs a year afterward. We now have 2.5 million people awaiting employment. In addition to that, there are 3.5 million seasonal and construction workers and female household heads. Hopefully, with the help of God, these problems will not exist in the future.
Iranian presidential candidate Saeed Jalili says he has plans to bring inflation in Iran under control. The former top nuclear negotiator also says he has plans to bring economic benefits to low-income families. The 55-year-old candidate pledged an elaborate health care plan for everyone in the country if he is elected president.
Regarding inflation, I have to say that the whole production cycle, I mean from production to consumption, has to be under the supervision of the government, and people can play a leading role here. If this production cycle is designed through using smart technologies and electronic government, many of our economic problems will be resolved. We have three major plans to get the lower deciles of the society out of the current economic crisis. We also have a comprehensive healthcare plan for all Iranian citizens in a way that people can make the most of their healthcare benefits with the least difficulty.
Mohsen Mehralizadeh says he believes an socio-economic approach as a remedy to Iran's ailing economy. He says his government will be able to provide much-needed services to the people of the country if elected president. The 64-year-old candidate says if economic policies are pursued in the way they should be, Iran can compete with the world's economic powers. Here's more.
Scandinavian countries came up with the idea of a social market economy in the 1930s. The socio-economic approach calls for the eradication of special economic rents and privileges for certain people. It also provides free and fair healthcare services, pensions, entertainment for all ages, and all sorts of services to the people of a country. We have all sorts of potentialities to become an economic power, like some countries in Europe. That includes young people, good education, decent facilities, natural resources, interaction with the world, and so on and so forth.
The candidates are scheduled to appear in two more live televised debates to outline their plans for the next 4 years. The second debate is going to be aired on Tuesday, June the 8th, and the last one will be aired next Saturday on June the 12th. The seven candidates will be given equal time to discuss their plans and answer the questions asked by the moderator in three-hour force. Well, that's a wrap for now. Thanks for tuning in.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has led a military parade in the besieged Gaza Strip after Israeli right-wing groups planned to march through flashpoint areas and occupy Jerusalem al-Quds. Members of the armed wing of Hamas marched through the streets of Gaza City. The military parade came after a senior figure in the movement warned that the Israeli settlers' march could spark a new escalation in the region. The Israeli regime later cancelled the so-called March of the Flag, citing a lack of authorization. Last month, Israel launched a war on Gaza after the besieged territory rose up in protest against Tel Aviv's escalations in the occupied West Bank. Hamas has repeatedly warned Israel that the movement is ready for any eventuality. Tony Gelsler, the head of the World Health Organization, has once again warned against the unequal COVID-19 vaccine distribution, saying such a policy has created a two-track pandemic.
6 months since the first vaccines were administered, high-income countries have administered almost 44% of the world's doses. Low-income countries have administered just 0.4%. The most frustrating thing about this statistic is that it hasn't changed in months. Globally, we continue to see encouraging signs in the trajectory of the pandemic. The number of new cases of COVID-19 reported to WHO has now declined for 6.
Adhanom Ghebreyesus underlined that while many countries still face dangerous situations, some wealthier nations are talking about going back to normal life. He warned that despite a global decrease in the number of new cases, Africa, the Americas, and the Western Pacific are still seeing an increase in their death toll. The WHO chief also called on the G7 leaders, who are set to meet in the United Kingdom, to commit to share the vaccine doses in June and July. Political commentator Abiyomi Azikiwe says without a joint international approach, the COVID-19 pandemic cannot be defeated.
I think it's representative of the narrow approach that the United States and other Western European countries have taken in regard to the COVID-19 pandemic. This pandemic cannot be fully resolved without having an international approach, and that is very much lacking on the part even of the Biden administration, which just came into office in January. In Africa now, you do in certain countries have rising statistics in regard to COVID infections. South Africa now is in its third wave. They're reporting 4,500 cases per day. So this is definitely a mounting problem. And even though the United States has promised to assist in regard to supplying vaccines, we see more effort being carried out by other countries.
Wraps up our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight. The protests for racial justice were wide-reaching. People from all walks of life in Britain, especially young people who took to the streets, were demanding racial justice. Not only concerned about anti-black racism in the United States, but also about deep and evident systemic racism in the United Kingdom. We now present you an article written by Richard Sudan. Richard Sudan is a journalist, writer, and television reporter. The piece is titled, New UK Police Powers Aiming to Shut Down Black Lives Matter Protests Must Be Stopped. Police crime sentencing and courts bill is on its way to becoming law, making its passage through the UK Parliament before passing through the House of Lords. In the latest move by the government to clamp down on a number of issues, including what they claim is unlawful disruption. However, the move, which aims to give the police more power to carry out their duties, has actually produced more of the very thing which critics claim is the whole reason the bill came into being in the first place, which is, of course, the very legitimate and critical right to protest. In 2020, mass demonstrations took place around the country from both Black Lives Matter supporters, galvanized by the mass global movements for justice following the murder of George Floyd in the United States, and also environmental activists raising alarm over the growing climate emergency. The protests for racial justice were wide-reaching. People from all walks of life in Britain, especially young people who took to the streets, were demanding racial justice. Not only concerned about anti-black racism in the United States of America, but also about deep and evident systemic racism in the United Kingdom. Environmental protesters and demonstrations also swept across the country, with some in London causing disruption to public transport in order to get their message across and to get their voices heard. And getting the message to the forefront of public debate is precisely the point of the protests. While the British government has focused on the toppling of statues and of the inconvenience to those using London trains to get to work to justify more police power, the reality is that should the police bill become law, it will likely be exploited to shut down very legitimate and lawful protests, with critics alarmed that the authorities will have the legal means to shut down and stifle any real criticism of the government at all. The problems of racial inequality, injustice, and of corruption and incompetence within the UK government, in many people's eyes, far outweigh and are of far greater concern than protesters stepping beyond the bounds of so-called legality. The right to protest in the United Kingdom is something purportedly sacred and is often talked about as being an essential cornerstone of Britain's so-called democracy. And yes, sometimes protests can get heated. But remember too that there are often serious questions about the conduct of the police, who many would argue themselves operate outside of the law, while at times being accused of breaking the law while operating with complete impunity. There has to be a balance, and listening to the concerns of legal experts and those with a keen eye on the importance of civil liberties, it isn't hard to see why there are serious concerns about the UK police having more powers. Many argue that the UK police need to correctly manage the existing powers which they already have and not be given more powers, which, as well as giving the police the power to keep people off the streets indefinitely, will also arguably impact and devastate the lives of Britain's traveller communities. Traveller communities have a way of life which is thousands of years old, and there are serious worries that the new police bill will be used in order to legally control their freedom of movement and to do the opposite of facilitating their way of life. Such communities are part of Britain's multicultural society and should have the same rights as everyone else and should not be treated as a nuisance to be pushed to the margins as the authorities see fit. The truth is that the British government was terrified by the collectivized message and power of protest movement last year, and in particular of the effectiveness of the Black Lives Matter movement, and the ability of such demonstrations to galvanize and inspire people to challenge power and the status quo. Also worth remembering is that a Metropolitan Police officer was charged with the murder of Sarah Everard. Some argue that there are serious problems within the police themselves, institutionally, which need rooting out, because they're given any more authority to adjudicate over the right of the public to mobilize, even if at times protests might become disruptive and hard for them to manage. When apartheid in South Africa was brought to an end, it was because mass global protests took place demanding it, and without such global protests, much needed change would have been jeopardized. Huge protests also just took place in London, demanding an end to apartheid in Palestine, with some even arguing that they were the biggest show of solidarity in the streets for the Palestinians which have ever taken place in Britain. This is something to be celebrated. But according to a new report, British media coverage of the recent Israeli aggression against the Gaza Strip was biased against Palestinians and skewed public impressions. The Muslim Council of Britain's Centre for Media Monitoring analysed the British media coverage of the conflict in a 44-page report entitled Media Reporting on Palestine 2021. The Muslim Council of Britain's Centre for Media Monitoring stated that during the 11-day war, there were 62,400 online print articles and 7,997 television broadcasts in the United Kingdom reporting on the incidents. The report has revealed that while there were some examples of balanced coverage, the overall narrative was unbalanced due to the skewed language, misleading headlines, and problematic framing. Rizwana Hamid, director of the Muslim Council of Britain's Centre for Media Monitoring and co-author of the report, told the Middle East Eye that the overwhelming amount of complaints about British media's biased coverage of events in Palestine aligned with the analysis and evidence of the monitoring organization. The report found that half of the broadcast media clips in the United Kingdom between 7th and 10th of May referred to the situation in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of the city of Al-Quds as an eviction or real estate dispute, which justifies the forced displacements of Palestinians, while the Israeli action were in contravention of international laws. Regarding Israeli police brutality against Palestinian protesters and worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, the investigation highlighted numerous examples of media sources utilizing terminology such as clashes, conflict, scuffles, and skirmishes to suggest equal blame. Rizwana Hamid said, as far as language is concerned, terms such as evictions mask the illegal forced removals and expulsion of Palestinians from their homes, adding that references to conflict and clashes try to equalize what is in effect a battle between David and Goliath. The Muslim Council of Britain's Centre for Media Monitoring also cited several news reports speaking of an intifada, which it said played into fear-mongering and framing Palestinians as violent aggressors. Thus, more protests calling to kill the bill regarding the proposed police powers have also been taking place, and they will continue. It's abundantly clear that the British people do not want this bill to become law and value their right to protest and to speak truth to power as sacred. Rather than ploughing ahead with its current plans, for once this current government should listen to the demands of what seems to be the vast majority of the British people. In fact, people's demand to protest and assemble is a fundamental right of any free society and is the essence of free speech. The British government seeking the power to shut this down wherever they see fit is draconian and is the opposite of what people expect from a decent democracy.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, and I'm Atar, the host of this program. We have two guest speakers in today's discussion, Brother Ali Alavian and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, thanks for inviting.
You're welcome, brother, and Brother Ali Alavian, assalamu alaikum to you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, thank you for having me here.
So regarding the main features of the hegemonic powers in today's world and the challenges that they are facing, for today's discussion we want to get a very important topic which was also tackled by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the Supreme Leader of Iran, and that is the challenges that the hegemonic powers have regarding the Islamic values in today's world. When you look at the pictures of some Muslim lands from outside, you find them very much similar in terms of architecture to the Western world nowadays, with the big, big towers and the big, big buildings, okay? So I do want to say that, yes, when they are attacking the Muslim lands and the Muslim values, they are attacking your system of values.
Mm-hmm.
So the system of values refers to your lifestyle, your culture. And the interesting point is that when they want to make documents about the Muslim lands, they do not capture your part of the country, which is like a Western world, but your original, aboriginal, we can say, cultures and the system of values. And they win many movies, and they win Oscar, they win Golden Globe, they win so many, you know, prizes all around the world. So the system of values is good. Very but true. As good as it shows you how simple you are, how servant
third
you are,
world.
Okay, third world country you are, and okay, wow, what a country you are. But when it comes to the exact system of values, for example, looking for justice, looking for freedom, Muslims are free, okay?
Mm-hmm.
They are not being oppressed. Then it becomes a challenge for the Western powers. Now we have to attack them. Now we have to put discrimination among them. Now we have to put...
And what I want to pinpoint, and one important point, brother, before we move towards, we actually go to a Sayyid. Actually they are trying, they are making very good lies to actually to deceive the whole world. Why? Under the name of democracy, this democratic movement actually, unlike before, that they came to actually to directly tell people that this is the power that we have and we need to colonize you and we need to take your power and to take your resources. Now they've got mature and they know what to do and how to deal with the people. Under the name of the democracy, they go and, for example, they attack one group and they let some other group, which is their servant, to be in power. Look. Like what the kind of way that they behave Saudi Arabia. Is there any democracy in Saudi Arabia, but they know it as a democratic nation and they do not even attack it once in a blue moon? You see? But In a country,
even they were harsher than Iran in terms of the women rights. Mm. They did not let the women to drive up 5-4 years ago, okay?
Yeah.
The women had no right to vote maybe in the country.
And they didn't have even ID.
There is no voting.
Oh, there's no voting. No, I mean, what kind? And all of a sudden, when Bin Salman comes to the scene, I mean, the son, may Allah curse him, you know, for the blood of the people, of the children of Yemen on his hand. When all of a sudden he comes to the scene, wow, the most famous singers from the U.S. are invited to the U.S. The most important WWE wrestlings are held over there. You know, the car race is over there. Singers come over there. Porn stars come over there. Is this a democracy?
Mm-hmm.
This is not a system of the values, brother.
Yeah.
You are losing your system of values day by day. And believe me, if this line continues, people are ready to ban their Hajj pilgrimage.
Mm-hmm.
Because you are the key holder, man, over there. What are you doing? Are you changing, for example, the Jeddah and the, you know, the other cities of the Saudi Arabia into what? A bar or a whorehouse or something like that? This is what, you know, and they are trapped. You know, like Trump said, we are milking you.
Mm.
Okay? We're milking you. Is it? Well, could you remember the picture Trump was showing to Bin Salman? These are the new facilities, the missiles and the airplanes and this and that. And you want to buy them?
$400 billion.
Yeah. And the Walden, and we milk you. Okay?
Mm.
So this is the milking sheep, and we have the milking goats.
And they're doing the same in other countries, but they do not call it directly, we're milking you. But they do milk the others.
Yes.
I don't want to name any other countries, even in our neighborhood. They are doing even worse than that under the name of democracy. But they are actually killing people, oppressing nations. But the outcome of which is to annihilate in their own view, in their
That's
own
right.
eyes. Annihilate what
That's
Islam
right.
wants
but,
and what
okay.
Islam is.
But Said Mohsen Nawi, I think the problem is also from the side of the planners and the Muslim lands too. Not to introduce these Islamic values in a foreign manner to its people and apply them also in your countries. Because the system of values over there, but how to apply them and how to make them applicable with today's daily life in the 21st century is also very important. It's difficult, but it's important, isn't it?
That is true. And the main reason is obviously when Muslim Ummah has forgot its own values, what can you expect from them? Obviously, the Western enemies, they are basically attacking the Muslim Ummah. They want to change this way of thinking. They want to make them their slaves. But when they forgot about their own values, then no one can help them. It is the duty of the scholars, basically.
Yes.
It is the duty of, you know, the education industry. You know why I said industry? Because in the West, they call it as an industry.
That's right.
It is the duty of scholarly people that they need to basically convey the values, and they need to remind the values which
okay.
they have. You know, the system in the school is now, unfortunately, for example, if I give you the example of Pakistan, for example, or other countries, if I can name them.
Yes.
The majority of school, there is a public school system, for example, that is for the poor people who do not have any money. And there is other school, private sector. Most of them, for example, in Pakistan, I can just name City School, Beacon House, I don't know. There are other schools. They all are either they have the syllabus of Oxford or Cambridge or
yes.
America.
Yes.
Now, when you teach your kids such syllabuses,
mm-hmm.
they're not going to learn about the values, the original values which are said by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's right.
Number one. Number two, you know, English language, it is an international language,
mm-hmm.
no doubt.
Yes.
We accept it, but this is not the main language. The main point is the people nowadays are trying to learn English.
Yes.
From the very basic, they're teaching their kids the English language, and now there is a level, for example, in the same countries, that the kids, they cannot even speak their mother language.
That's
which
right.
is, for example, Urdu, Punjabi, for
yes.
example, like any.
But they cannot speak English.
They can speak English.
Once I was talking to a scholar in Qom City, he was an Ayatollah. He told me that I do not let my kid to get into learn English language, an Iranian, from very beginning, I mean 7-8 years old. Say, why? This is a good age. He said, because first I have to make him familiar with his own system of values, okay, in terms of the language, system, culture, everything. And you know that learning a language brings with itself its own culture. But if a guy, for example, is a teenager, 15, 16 years old, and then he's, I mean, the bases on the foundation are strong now.
Strong, yes.
Then he's going to, for example, learn English language. But the case is, brother, this, that unfortunately, the people who are in charge of leading the countries in the Muslim lands themselves are not familiar with these concepts, are not familiar with the system of the values in the true sense of the word. And they are also playing with the same cards that the Westerners are playing.
It's because, unfortunately, there was a time when the Western world was ruling the Muslim lands as well. Yeah, for example, you know, the Britons, the East India Company, has ruled subcontinent India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka for, you know, many years. And they have their impacts when they were leaving. They divided everyone into different groups, and then they left. You know, Australia is under the England's, you know, we can say like kingdom.
Yes.
Canada is part of that. In Indo-Pak, we can say like subcontinent, like they were there. In Iran, we can see like the French and Americans,
yeah,
who were the
Portuguese.
Main, yes. And the rest of the world, if you see, the Muslim Ummah basically is affected by these people who came into power, who oppressed and who basically conquered, in a way, these lands. And later,
yes,
these lands were freed by themselves. The Ottoman Empire, it was obviously, you know, dispersed by the same powers, the Western powers.
That's right.
Why they attacked the Ottoman emperorship? It's because they didn't want it. Like they never wanted Muslims to be in the power.
That's right.
Similarly, when you give the example of bin Salman, it's again the same thing.
Yes.
It's a guy who is an Arab, mm-hmm, and who is living in a place, most sacred place in the world, like obviously Muslims go,
yes,
for the Hajj and all those,
yes,
but even in the same land where the Prophet,
yeah,
removed or eliminated all these things,
mm-hmm,
the examples which you gave,
yes,
you know, the things which he eliminated, he is bringing those things back.
Yes.
Before the Prophet, people used to do Hajj while they were naked.
And the
know,
sound is about the
nudity,
silence of the,
yes,
Muftis over there.
Mm. No, it's not because of that, because, you know, the news says that. It's apparent, like the Western news also says that.
Mm-hmm.
Many Muftis or the scholars who were against these things,
mm-hmm,
they are in prison.
Yes.
Or some of them has got killed,
yes,
by bin Salman and his,
yes,
you know, regime.
Yes.
So this Ali Saud bin Salman is not a criteria. Having the keys of Kaaba is not the criteria,
yes,
of knowing that this person is on the right side and the others are on the wrong. Because many of the, you know, many of the princes, the princes in Saudi Arabia are in prison.
Mm-hmm.
We can see, you know, that columnist who got killed in Turkey.
Jamal Khashoggi.
Yeah.
Jamal Khashoggi. Yes.
Jamal Khashoggi. Why he got killed? What was the reason? You know, other princes,
yes,
like in Turkey or the other countries.
He was a journalist,
got,
yes.
Yeah.
Man, he was suffocated for 10 minutes. Then,
mm,
he was chopped off into different pieces.
Mm.
Then he was melted into the acid. Wow, man, what? Come on. And the world is being quiet. At the time of Trump presidency,
and it is democratic,
the world was quiet. Now the Biden presidency, the world is quiet. They say, okay, shall we look for that or shall we not?
And they're
so
still observant in the Human
Rights
Commission.
They call it democracy
commission.
And they call,
yeah,
it justice, yeah?
Yeah.
According, mm, to them.
Yes, brother.
No, the surprise is that they are still observer of the Human Rights Commission,
mm-hmm,
in the UN, and no one says anything. And America is also, and the West is defending them.
Yes.
As their friend, as a country that actually follows human rights.
Let me make,
okay,
one more thing clear, that in the world we see, you know, these powers, the,
yes,
Western powers, they're talking about democracy and the justice. Who started the world war?
Mm-hmm.
Who were those people?
That's
these
right.
were these people who started, and they had the fight.
Okay.
World War One, World War Two.
Yes.
How many people got killed?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if United Nations was not built,
yes,
you know, if it wasn't created,
mm-hmm,
this war was gonna obviously
That's all right.
Continue. till now, and still they're looking for a war. For example, the things which Israel is doing, the things which America has done in Iraq, in Syria, you know, funding the ISIS and you know, other terrorist groups, Taliban. These all are funded by America.
That's all right. The people, both men and women, have to get back and have a return to their, you know, true system of values. I could remember that recently in the news, I saw that the female German team of gymnastics, okay, has covered all their bodies from neck to toe. Why? Because they said that when in the previous years we were over there with naked eyes, the men over there mocked us and betrayed us, and they looked at us as a sexual toy. So now we are covering from neck to toe to not have a sexual look at us, okay? This is an Islamic value. I mean, this is what that covering your body with protection
brother,
to you.
This is the rationalism that Islam actually focuses on.
Yes.
And now, and one of the key, let's say, points that even the hegemonic power is attacking Islam for, this rationalism is going to spread in the whole world. Look, when people slowly want to find themselves, be back to the true teachings of the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny, they are actually attacking this.
That's
and this
right.
is what we have been actually saying from over four decades.
And unfortunately, from inside, some people are attacking it too. This is the sad news. Okay, thank you very much, Brother Ali Alavian and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, for your nice elaboration regarding how to revive the Islamic system of values that is a really a big challenge for the Westerners and hegemonic powers to tackle. First, they are attacking your system of values, then they are attacking your land, then they are attacking your resources, and day by day you can see that in terms of clothes, hairstyle, lifestyle, everything, food style, you are a Westerner but living in the eastern part of the world, and this is the sad news. It was very kind of you, dear listeners. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. These series are produced by Brother Mahmoud. Please bring your comments and ideas. We can say on our email address, coi@irib.ir. Also, you can visit our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Do not forget to visit our website, parstoday.com/Ian. Call of Islam page. Another episode. God bless you all. Fi amanillah.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
the limelight. Corals will bleach, penguins will lose their Arctic ice floes. Puffins around the United Kingdom coast will be unable to feed their young. And the black-headed squirrel monkey of the Amazon could be wiped out if the world fails to limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's environment correspondent Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled, Key Species at Risk If Planet Heats Up by More Than 1.5 degrees Celsius, report finds. Corals will bleach, penguins will lose their Antarctic ice floes, and puffins around the United Kingdom coast will be unable to feed their young. And black-headed squirrel monkeys of the Amazon jungle could be wiped out if the world fails to limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Beyond the 1.5 degrees Celsius rise, many species will face increasing problems finding food and surviving, according to a new report from the World Wildlife Fund, on the effects of climate breakdown on 12 key species across the world. In the United Kingdom, puffins are facing increasing threats from warming seas. Sand eels form a large part of the seabirds' diet, and the sand eels depend on crustaceans called copepods. Now, however, warming seas mean copepods are blooming before the sand eels hatch. And the sand eels miss out on their meals, there are fewer for puffins to catch, and entire colonies can fail as a result. The World Wildlife Fund found that between 2000 and 2016, copepods were blooming nearly 20 days earlier than sand eel larvae were hatching, a mismatch likely to widen as higher temperatures take hold. The report found that the effects of global heating, which has already reached more than 1 degree Celsius above pre-industrial levels, could already be seen in the United Kingdom. For instance, mountain hares in the highlands of Scotland grow white coats for camouflage in winter, but the snow is melting earlier before their coats have returned to brown, leaving them exposed to predators. While warming of 0.5 degrees Celsius above current levels may seem small, the report found the effects will be harmful to a wide variety of species, including snow leopards, hippopotamuses, monkeys and frogs, sea turtles and coral. Leatherback turtles are sensitive to even slight changes in temperature, as the sex of the turtle is determined while the egg incubates in the sand. Hotter sand means more females and not enough males, and can mean eggs fail to hatch at all. The report also examined the fate of the black-headed squirrel monkey of the Amazon rainforest, which lives in a floodplain, so a single large flooding event of the kind forecast to become more frequent at 1.5 degrees Celsius could wipe out the whole of the population. Commercial interests around the world will also be threatened if temperature rises above 1.5 degrees Celsius, with coffee plantations vulnerable to rising temperatures. Nearly 90% of Arabica coffee plantations in South America could become unsuitable for the crop by 2050. Mike Barrett, the executive director of science and conservation at the World Wildlife Fund, said the climate crisis was adding to a huge loss of wildlife. Global wildlife populations have already plummeted by 68% since 1970. Nature is our life support system, and its continued destruction is not only devastating local wildlife and communities, but creating a hotter, less stable planet, putting our very survival at risk, he said. This isn't a far-off threat. the impacts of climate change are already being felt, and if we don't take action now to keep global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, we will slide faster and faster towards catastrophe. The World Wildlife Fund also found that protecting vital habitats would be essential to stop warming, global warming exceeding 1.5 degrees Celsius. The more landscapes are denuded of vegetation and their complex ecologies, the faster the climate crisis is likely to take hold. For instance, degraded and polluted marine environments mean the seas can absorb less carbon dioxide. Deforestation destroys carbon sinks, and the dying out of peatlands and wetlands releases more carbon dioxide into the air. Tanya Steele, the chief executive at World Wildlife Fund, said the report showed why governments needed to strengthen their pledges on cutting greenhouse gas emissions before the crunch United Nations climate talks, COP26, to be held in Glasgow, Scotland this November. Many countries, including the United Kingdom and the United States, as well as the European Union countries, have already promised steep cuts in carbon dioxide emissions by 2030. But taken together, this would still lead to a rise of 2.4 degrees Celsius by the end of this century, according to new scientific estimates. Tanya Steele said, world leaders must seize the chance at COP26 to build a greener, fairer future, one with nature at its heart. As host, the United Kingdom government needs to show it can deliver on its climate targets by publishing a credible action plan without delay, outlining the steps it will take to cut harmful greenhouse gas emissions and reach net zero emissions. Ministers must also recognize nature's vital role in helping to deliver a 1.5 degrees Celsius world and urgently scale up efforts to protect and restore nature, both at home and overseas.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.